Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. From Flint, Michigan to the American West to parched countries all over the world, water stories are big these days. And above all, water shortage, drought, depletion. Las Vegas is a desert city, one of the driest cities in the United States. Now Las Vegas wants to become the Silicon Valley of water innovation. This hour On Point, water lessons from dry Las Vegas for a thirsty world. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you seeing a water scarcity where you live? How has it affected you, your community? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Talk about Las Vegas, and its big water supply traditionally has come from Nevada's Lake Mead, up from the Grand Canyon there, not so many miles from Las Vegas. Last summer, if you've seen pictures of it or if you've been there, it is way, way, way down from the level it once had. And this is the main water supply. CBS News reporter John Blackstone spoke with a park ranger at Nevada's Lake Mead, which now holds 37% of its capacity, a record low. They stood at the water's edge.
If we were standing here in the 1990s, we'd be under how much water?
We would probably have a good 100 feet of water above our heads right now.
100 feet of water?
100 feet of water, yes.
100 feet of water missing from a massive reservoir. That gets a city's attention. Now the city trying to turn its expertise to the world. Joining me from Washington is Ted Goldman. He's written a piece for Political called Las Vegas is Betting. It can become the Silicon Valley of water. Welcome, Ted. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So why Las Vegas? We thought they had water problems. You're saying they've got water answers.
They've had water answers, apparently. What happened was that a drought started about the turn of the millennium, around 1999, 2000. The snowpack from where the Colorado River actually gets its water was at 25%. It was quite clear that they were going to not have nearly as much water as they used to have. And so they implemented some very, very stringent conservation measures almost within a couple of years. Immediately, they banned front lawns, no more front lawns. And they said, if you want to build a house, and you can have a lawn in the backyard, but it can only be half. If you have a commercial property, you can have no lawns, zero. And while this might seem a small thing, outdoor watering is a big, big deal. And immediately they noticed some incredible savings.
Okay, but that makes you a global technology leader in water, banning, watering your front yard?
Fair enough, but that's the beginning. So all this took place within a certain mentality, a certain mindset that the Southern Nevada Water Authority has had for probably a couple of decades. It's always been a very forward-thinking water authority, and it's always been sort of on the forefront of innovation. And innovation in the water context, I learned, is a pretty specific thing. First of all, water authorities are incredibly conservative, and they have to be because their primary concern is health. And so if they experiment—
And that it's always got to be there.
Exactly. And they can't have any mistakes. And once you have a mistake, as Flint points out, I mean, it's a big, big, big deal. And so they're conservative by nature. And so the problem for innovation in the water industry is that it's very hard to find, and you can't find it. Who wants to be the guinea pig? Who wants to try something out? And so, ironically, the seeds of this sort of Silicon Valley that they're trying to develop in Vegas came with the recession, because the recession that started in 2008 and hit Nevada probably harder than any other state, perhaps than Florida, proved to them that they can't make a go with only casinos and resorts. And I mean, the economy just fell out of bed. And at the same time, they revamped their economic development team for the state, and they focused on Las Vegas in part. And they said, you guys have always sort of been at the forefront of water innovation and water technology. You've cut your use way down over the last 10 years. Let's see if we can develop an incubator that will sort of start to bring water technology, innovative water technology, to our area. And that's what they've done.
To the middle of a desert. Here's Nevada's Governor Brian Sandoval. This is a press conference last spring, about a year ago, talking about the impact of drought on the state. Las Vegas, of course, right there. And he gave his press conference in a barren field
that just a few years ago was part of the floor of Washoe Lake and said that when he was growing up, the spot he was standing in was underwater.
Where we're all standing right now, we should be standing in 3 feet of water. And if you look behind me, I think there are some children or family out there. That's a half a mile approximately from here where the nearest water is. So obviously where we stand now is replaced by dust.
Replaced by dust. And we've got water problems all over the place. The American West has had plenty. You look at the projections for the increases in annual water demand from 2005 to 2030. And we're talking in China about, more than 250% more water demand. India, nearly the same. Sub-Saharan Africa, above 200%. North America, above 200%, doubling in that time, while population's going up, water use, water problems aplenty. Ted, remind us of Las Vegas' history with water. I mean, in Spanish, it means the meadows, but dryness has always been a real issue. I guess there was an artesian spring there at one time, but as Las Vegas began to grow, where did they look for their water? What kind of deals has Nevada cut?
Well, you're right. It was founded where a spring was, and that spring actually put out water until 1962. But right now, the city and the six other states right around it are operating under a 1922 compact. And it's this incredibly complicated compendium of laws and regulations and treaties, and that effectively, back in 1922, set the amount of water that Las Vegas could that Nevada could take out of Lake Mead. And It's a number that they were set to overtake. But then in the early 2000s, when they instituted some of these conservation measures, they started to ratchet that back. So right now, they're okay. They've got plenty. They've got enough space.
300,000 acre feet. This is for Las Vegas or Nevada?
This is for Nevada.
And this is a 1 acre foot. You say that's the amount of water covering 1 acre of land, 1 foot deep, about 325,000 gallons? Wait
right.
a minute. Oh, that's one, and they get 300,000 of those. That's a lot of water, but they're actually using less now?
They're using less than they were 10 or 15 years ago. And that's because, here's the funny thing, the thing I didn't realize, is that when you talk about the consumption of water, especially in a city that's really a desert city, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's not supposed to be a city there. It's a bit artificial.
They're in a bunch of other places in the American
exactly,
world.
Exactly. When you talk about water, in Las Vegas right now, of every gallon taken out of Lake Mead, 40% of that water is used indoors and is returned to Lake Mead, which means they can take it out again, and it doesn't count against their allotment. But 60% of that water is used for outdoor use. It used to be as high as 70%.
Okay, they're cutting that down.
They're cutting that way down. And so it turns out that one of the easiest and quickest ways to cut your water consumption is just to limit outdoor use. And that's basically what they did. And then they added the recycling in.
How do you recycle? And once it's used, what does that mean? It's been used to wash dishes, to brush teeth, for sewage?
It's called gray water.
Yeah.
It can include sewage. And actually, Las Vegas is very lucky because one of the problems, a gallon of water weighs 8 pounds.
Okay.
And energy use is a big factor in how you use your water and how water authorities are
moving it around.
Environment.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. They're lucky. Lake Mead is only 15 miles away.
Yep.
So the water that comes out of drain pipes in all the houses and all the casinos in Las Vegas ends up in one area. It's treated and it's shipped back up to Lake Mead. It's put actually in a wash, they call it, and then it's shipped up to Lake Mead where it replenishes their allotment, but it's not hard to ship it up to Lake Mead. You couldn't do that in, say, other cities where the reservoir is perhaps sometimes 100 miles away.
Right. What about the quality of that water? I mean, they're dumping used water back into their primary water source. Are there quality
issues?
Well,
it's been treated. It's been treated.
Used, but treated. Yep.
Right. Actually, this is one of the hardest things to overcome with the whole idea of reusing water. It's a big movement in the United States, and it's actually something that most other municipalities are going to have to do.
Is this water that has flushed urinals?
It's water that's done everything. Any water that's on the inside of the house used for any purpose.
Okay.
And toilets are about
included.
A quarter of...
Yeah.
Exactly. Toilets are about a quarter of indoor water use. It's all going down the same area. It's all being treated.
And it goes back in the same reservoir that everybody uses. Is that rare in this country or is that now common? I just hadn't caught up with that.
It's still fairly unusual. But if you... According to the Water Authority, the water they put back in Lake Mead is cleaner than the water that goes into Lake Mead from the Colorado River because it doesn't have the sediment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fairly established technology, but not that many municipalities are using it because they don't have to.
Yeah, and who would if you didn't have to? And I mean, politically, I suppose at first it's not popular, but Vegas doing it. And out of that, out of economic need on the one hand, after the recession.
Right.
And, of course, they got a lot of people coming through there. That I mean, they can't have water shortages. That would be hell on their tourism business.
No, it's 40 million visitors a year out of a city with just 2 million people. It's probably one of the highest ratios in the world.
So they're putting themselves out there as a water innovation center.
That's what they're trying to do. And the idea is you create this virtuous circle. You get a couple of companies that can come in from Israel, from the UK, from the East Coast, from anywhere. Mm-hmm. And they get the local water authority, the Southern Nevada Water Authority, which is actually very large. And they get them to test run their products. And if they like them, they buy them. And then they go out to their marketing folks and they say, hey, SNWA is using this. It works very well. And if SNWA is using it, that's good enough for almost everyone else. And that's the crux of the Water Start or their little incubator, is that they provide this link. The problem with incubators is you get these great innovators from all over the place. They come up with these products and they don't know what to do with them. Who do they sell them to? How do they find a market?
Las Vegas can use them right off the bat and be a kind of a proof of concept place with its arid environment and its 40 million visitors a year.
Right, right. If you can succeed in Las Vegas, I suppose they could transplant the New York story there, yeah.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound of slot machines there at the Luxor Casino in Las Vegas on the Strip. We're looking this hour at America's thirstiest city, 40 million visitors a year, in its driest state, looking to meet its water challenge and become a global hub of water use innovation. Las Vegas, looking to master water use technology in a very, very thirsty world. Ted Goldman is with us. He's written about it for Politico. You can see his piece at our website. And you can join us this hour. Is this the place where necessity may be the mother of invention? Have you seen the pictures of Lake Mead, the Las Vegas water source, looking like a drained bathtub? And can innovation save us here? Or are we just up against the hard limits of water supply? Here's just a bit of that famous water show, the Fountain of Fountains at the Bellagio, shot by a spectator. You can hear the water running under the introduction to the Michael Jackson song, Billie Jean. Remember that scene at the end of Ocean's 11 when they're all outside and the fountain's going, massive and beautiful in the dark? But this is a desert city. Here's a public service announcement put out by the Southern Nevada Water Association, saying, hey, they're watching a middle-aged man change his watering clock. It's a clock that regulates his sprinkling system to conserve water.
There's nothing sexier than saving water. Change your watering clock to one day a week. Find your mandatory watering schedule at changeyourclock.com.
Mandatory watering schedules, and there's nothing sexier than saving water. That's important in a place like Las Vegas. Ted Goldman, standby in Washington. Nate Allen joins us right now. He's executive director of Water Start. This is the nonprofit, Nevada-based kind of incubator, partners with water technology innovators in the academic and public and private sector. Nate Allen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
So we think of low-flow shower heads and restrictions on watering our lawn, but you've got bigger plans than that. When it comes to water use and innovation, please give us a sense of the kind of companies and products you're working with. I think some people may be scratching their heads.
Sure. Well, what we've done is we've put a process in place where first we go around to agencies, large water consumers throughout the state, and we survey them on what their biggest challenges are in terms of managing their water. And the needs that get identified for us are on a broad spectrum. Everything from distributed water quality monitoring, conservation-related technologies, leak detection, security, a whole variety of things. And you know, one of the real drivers of all of those priorities is that water's going through a real change right now because of drought, because of water scarcity.
Yep.
Where, you know, here you have all of these utilities that, you know, really in order to secure the water supply, need to put in conservation. But a lot of those conservation measures end up killing revenue. And so it puts them in a really awkward position where they've got to be able to figure out how to innovate in other ways so that they can stay afloat and provide reliable, clean drinking water for their ratepayers.
So you're all over this. You've got one called Ecologix, and what this is, a detection monitoring for leaks. If there's the tiniest leak, you get to know right away so you're not wasting?
Yeah, that's right. Ecologix has actually been around for a few years. We were able to recruit them here. Their mobile inspection systems were adopted very early on here in Las Vegas. Actually, they sold their first prototype out of the trunk of their car to the guys here at the Water District about 10 years ago. Last spring, then, we got them to test and install a new system that's a permanent leak detection system along 3 miles of the Las Vegas Strip. So as soon as a leak develops there, we know about it.
How big a deal is that, Nate? How big a deal is that in Las Vegas or elsewhere? Are we losing a lot of water to leakage?
Well, I think nationally the rates are something like 20% of all water produced is lost. Now, whether that's lost to miscalculation, lost to misuse, lost to leaks, it's a combination. But here in Las Vegas, our number is 5%.
That's cool. That's a lot better than 20, because you need it badly.
Absolutely.
You've got distributed water quality monitoring. What's that about? Would that have saved Flint, Michigan from its problems?
I think, you know, the stuff with Flint, Michigan, honestly, there's a lot of mismanagement there. It's not really a technology issue. It could have been very well predicted.
However, wait a minute. There's lead in the water. That's a quality problem.
It's a quality problem, but it hadn't been until they changed their water supply,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So and then they did damage to their existing infrastructure. Now, all that said, we know that water changes from the time it leaves the treatment plant to the time that it gets to your tap, right?
Yeah. Yep. Wait a minute. Wait, how does it? I want to know more about that. How? I thought it was like a gurgling mountain stream.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's a long distance when you get into cities like Los Angeles, New York, even Boston.
Sitting in those pipes.
It's a long distance from one place to another, right?
Yeah.
And conditions in temperature, conditions in pressure, conditions, a variety of conditions can change from one location to another. And utilities now, currently, the EPA regulates that they go out and manually inspect in different places throughout the distribution system water quality, right, in order to make sure that, by and large, the water quality is safe. From our standpoint, we're now interested in doing that at a higher resolution. And so we've started adopting some real-time sensors. Some of those sensors are going in pipes. Some of those sensors are going in storage facilities that we have spread across the city, where, honestly, in order to ensure that the water is of the right quality, we end up spending a lot more money on electricity to keep that water cycling more than it may need to, but in order to maintain the quality. Putting in real-time sensors can tell us exactly what's going on with the quality there so that we can even save and optimize our operations.
I think a lot of people across the country looking at what happened in Flint probably like the idea of real-time sensors distributed throughout the water distribution system, keeping track of whether it's good or not.
Of course.
This idea of smart water. It's bringing water into the sort of 21st century and bringing it into the app world, really.
Yep.
Smart water in the 21st century. We've got a listener in Alaska who says, why don't you, you've got all kinds of water east of the Continental Divide, why don't you just pipe in water from the eastern U.S. where it's far more plentiful, Nate?
I think it's an economic thing, right? I mean, I think that a lot of people like to talk about those kinds of projects. Frankly, we have a hard time even coordinating on getting nuclear waste shipped across the U.S., right? And building the infrastructure to move something across or a gas pipeline. These are major, major challenges. And honestly, I think that we could start at a much more basic level where we can optimize how our water is consumed and produced and become more efficient first.
Let's go to our listeners. They're paying close attention here. Many, of course, have been to Vegas. Arnie in Needham, Massachusetts. Arnie, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
A number of times I've been to Las Vegas, and maybe your point before the first break, where you reuse the water is going to make this moot. But there's a lot of toilets that flush automatically. You walk past some urinals, and you might get two or three of them to flush sometimes. You're using a regular bathroom, and you have to actually have it flushed twice because it flushes as soon as you move
right.
or stand up,
right.
and you don't have time to do the rest of the things you need to do. And I know in Massachusetts, you know, it seems like you have to waste water to when it's automatic, whereas if you're at home, you only flush once.
Arnie, let us pick it up. Nate Allen, you call yourselves water innovators, and your toilets are flushing automatically all the time.
Well, I mean, this is a perfect example to that point I was talking about a second ago, right? I mean, the opportunity for optimizing how we use water with the infrastructure that we already have is huge. You know, automated toilets that flush on their own and that are low-flow toilets, they're not a perfect exact science yet. They've got room to grow there, and I think we've got some opportunities here in Las Vegas in order to push that market. I mean, you can see examples already here. You know, MGM is one of our partners now. When they built the city center complex with the Aria, you know, they reviewed hundreds of low-flow shower heads, which were brand new to the market. Nobody had ever really installed them at massive scale anywhere.
Yeah.
They ended up, you know, testing all these different kinds. They really pushed that industry, that product line, to come up with significant new quality standards and how long they last, how reliable their estimates of flow rate really are. And in the end, they purchased thousands of those low-flow shower heads.
But I got a question on that, because I know I've seen a press thing somewhere that you're teaming up with MGM.
Mm-hmm.
Those 40 million people who come to Vegas, they're not in the mood for low-flow shower heads, are they? I mean, you come to Vegas to be profligate. That's kind of the image, right? To, like, live
yep.
large.
Yeah.
40 million people, how do you get them to clamp down on water use? They want to take baths in those giant, up in the penthouse, you know, with the giant tub and all that.
Absolutely. So let me give you a couple of numbers, okay?
Yeah.
So first, when you look at all the water consumed in the state of Nevada, 11% of that water goes to serve Las Vegas municipally, right? So the whole city. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the largest population center of the state uses about 11%. 3% of that 11% gets used on the Las Vegas Strip. There's been a tremendous amount of investment over the last decade, over the last two decades, in how to use water effectively. There's a tremendous amount of water recycling and reuse going on down there. Back to the shower heads, I mean, this is one of those things that we pushed the industry on here as a large purchaser of these. I mean, let's be real.
Okay.
Does anybody, whether they're in Las Vegas or not, actually want to take a low-flow shower? No, you want it to feel like a great shower, right?
Yeah.
With pressure,
yeah.
feeling like you're getting clean, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's up to the technology companies to figure out how to do that. Use less water without sacrificing the quality of the experience.
And what about that giant fountain in front of the Bellagio? We all saw it in Ocean's 11. Is that still out there evaporating into the Nevada skies?
yeah, of course it's out there. It's a tremendous attraction. People really enjoy it here. It's all water that's been recycled from other locations within the Bellagio facilities.
Does it smell good?
I'm sorry?
Does it smell good?
It does every time I'm down there.
Okay.
You know, but I think that, you know, back to my point about, in generally, you know, what does our state look like? WaterStart was really set up, as Tom was mentioning, as kind of both a response to two simultaneous events: a major drought and changing climate, and the economic downturn. How can we kind of leverage these two things happening now in order to create economic growth? And we then have set up metrics that basically use a very simple equation. It's dollars per gallon per job. And when you look at how much water is consumed down on the Las Vegas Strip, up in Reno, you know, all over the state, how do we get more economic impact for the gallons that we have? That's really the question we're looking at. And in things like the Bellagio Fountain, there's a pretty decent return.
Nate Allen at WaterStart there in Las Vegas. Please stand by. And Ted Goldman in Washington, who's written about this for Politico. Brian Richter joins us right now from Charlottesville, Virginia, chief scientist for the Global Water Program at the Nature Conservancy. He is all over water issues. Worldwide, author of Chasing Water, Rivers for Life. Brian Richter, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
When you see this effort in Las Vegas, driest city in a dry, thirsty city in a dry state, and they got a lot of things going on technologically here, does it look like a solution to you, or are they dancing on the edge of a cliff anyway? I mean, we hear all about these problems of Western water use, drought, who's going to have what in the decades ahead? Populations keep growing. Can this be solved? Can it be a big enough solution to make the West balance out the simple absence of water that we've seen the drought in Nevada, we've seen drought in California? Can you innovate your way out of that?
Well, Tom, I think these measures that are being put into place in Las Vegas and many, many other cities around the world to try to reduce their water demands, to try to shrink their water footprint, are incredibly important. But I do want to bring a little bit of a different perspective in here.
Good.
And that is that by the time of World War II, half of the Colorado River was gone. It was being used up. By the early 1960s, three-quarters of the river was gone. And you should ask the question of where was all the water going? Well, the vast majority of that water that was being taken out of the Colorado River was going to irrigated agriculture. And so cities like Las Vegas and many, many other cities that are dependent upon that river system have been trying to grow and expand in the context of a water supply that was already being heavily exhausted at that point. And so
that's exactly my point. I mean, if there's just not enough water, does innovation or technology fix it?
Well, I think that's the point I want to make here, Tom, is that I think we should keep pushing as hard as we can on water conservation and technology developments, use of recycling, even the use of desalination, taking the salt out of ocean water or salty groundwater. But the real breakthroughs, in my perspective, are going to come from making big advancements in how much water we're using out in irrigated agriculture to grow our crops, to grow our food. And, you know, here's just one statistic to put it all in perspective, I think. If we could find a way to save just 10% in the water that's being used down on the farms, we could actually double the size of all of our cities and industries, you know, within the Colorado River Basin, within the Western U.S., globally. And so I think the potential for us to get ourselves out of this terrible mess that we're in with facing water shortages and water scarcity time after time, drought after drought, I think we really have to put a lot of emphasis out on the farms as well.
Nate, we just got a minute before the break here, and I want to look in more detail at what you're doing. And it's not – no disrespect to any of it. I think it's great. But what about the simple issue of water use, how it's used and how much there is? How much of that can you innovate your way out of?
I think that there's a ton of opportunity to innovate, right? And but I think the point is well made that the vast majority of the water consumed is not coming out of the urban centers. And we've got new partners coming on now, some of the largest ag producers in the state, where we're trying to help them innovate as well.
Wow. Ted, you reported this. Have you got optimism here that this is a bigger solution than the nifty stuff on the edges? Can it deal with the mismatch of population of water and ag in the West in general?
And they're looking at things like drones. They're looking at precision tuning of the irrigation, because I think it's around 70% of all water is used for irrigation or used for farming. So that's just a huge chunk of what's out there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is on Point, and we're talking about Las Vegas putting itself out there, thirsty city in the driest state in the Union, putting itself out there as a laboratory for water innovation, water use innovation. You can join us this hour. Do you want a low-flow shower when you go to Vegas? And what have you seen around the world when it comes to water shortage? Can Las Vegas and innovation fix it? Can we innovate our way out of water shortage? Ted Goldman has written about the Vegas Initiative for Politico. You can link to his piece at our website, onpointradio.org. Nate Allen is Executive Director of Water Start. It's the incubator, the group that is spearheading this attempt to address water issues and be an economic generator for the Las Vegas area. Brian Richter is with us, Chief Scientist in the Global Water Program at the Nature Conservancy, Water Advisor to the United Nations, President of Sustainable Waters, a global water education program. He's got the big global view here. Lots of response online here. Here's a listener on the website saying, what portion of the water in Vegas is used by the 30 golf courses in the Vegas area? Nate, trimming back on golf the big innovation, or is that a big deal?
It is significant. There's been a lot of work done on that area in the last couple of years where we have, you know, set up infrastructure to supply golf courses with reused water, as well as helping them transition to using other kinds of landscapes in the roughage. It's certainly an opportunity for innovation and water savings. There's no question about that. However, the evaporative cooling systems that cool much of the office complexes, strip or otherwise, throughout the city and frankly, most of the country, you know, those evaporative cooling systems use way more water. So we're focusing both on how do you do better conservation using water outside, but also as well as other significant demands on city supply.
Brian, you look at water issues all over the world, and of course we see these pictures of people in Sahara and sometimes even sub-Saharan Africa, Sudan, elsewhere, walking miles and miles to bring water back to their village. Really serious issues. And then here you've got Las Vegas, a kind of symbol of excess and material, you know, whoop-de-doo, in the middle of a desert. So does all this effort make sense to you, Brian, to keep Las Vegas, you know, juiced in the middle of a desert?
Well, I'm really glad that we're having this discussion about Las Vegas, and I really appreciate what Nate has said about their efforts out there. People like to point fingers at Las Vegas, but, you know, as you've emphasized during the course of the show, Las Vegas has made some tremendous progress, tremendous investments in trying to get their water needs down to the lowest possible level, and I think they need to be recognized for that. I think that going forward, I think we're going to have to continue to look for ways to shrink that water demand in cities. The smaller the need, then the less vulnerable you are to ending up being short during droughts. But I think that there are many, many other places that we can look. And one that I'll point out, one innovation that I think is really interesting, I mentioned a moment ago about the water use out in irrigated agriculture, out on the farms. Mm-hmm. And I have tremendous respect for farmers and grew up in an extended family of farmers in Texas. And this is not about, you know, being accusational or trying to vilify what they're trying to do with the water. We've asked so much of them to feed our country, to feed, you know, the larger world. But I think there's opportunities for some innovative partnerships between cities like Las Vegas or San Diego or Los Angeles to work with farmers in a very collaborative way that keeps the farmers in control, but provides some support to them, particularly financial support, to enable them to start making some investments and trying to squeeze some of that water out of the farms while remaining as productive or more productive than they are today.
Nate, are you working on ag water issues? I mean, we see all this concern about how much water goes there. Maybe because they're entitled to it, they don't feel pressure to be more innovative, though when the drought comes, they have to. But is that part of your writ as well at WaterStart?
Absolutely. We've recently brought on a partner called Winnemucca Farms that irrigates about 16,000 acres up in northern Nevada in Winnemucca, and working with them very much through the same kind of process that we work with the Southern Nevada Water Authority, where we've sat down with them, we've started to identify what their big priorities are, what their big challenges are, and then we start to recruit technologies that they think would help solve their problems. We actually did the first flight yesterday morning at that site of a new kind of imaging sensor that goes on to a drone to fly over the kinds of crops that they have there that oftentimes don't have the tools and the software developed yet for those kinds of crops. So this is absolutely a topic that we're focusing on, and I think Brian makes a really good point. You know, the interesting thing that's going on in the West right now, which I don't think as poignant a conversation is happening in the East, is there's a serious recognition here that we're all in this together. You know, the majority of the water that's coming out of Lake Mead is going to California, way more than Arizona or Nevada. And it, you know, you talk about farmers feeling entitled to water. Everybody before the water scarcity issues kicked in, felt very entitled. But it's hard to feel entitled to something that is going away, right? And so Nevada, especially in the last 6 months, has held a drought forum where the governor has hosted meetings all across the state for people to really weigh in and really define what their biggest challenges and needs are. And it's led to a really significant list of changes that now policymakers are considering in the next legislative session.
I mean, huge issues here. Anytime you've got water issues in a dry place, California's had plenty. Here was Governor Jerry Brown, this was last year, describing the problem there in the most basic terms. Too many people living in a desert.
We all face a challenge because California, for 10,000 years, had only 300,000 or so residents. When you up that number to 38 million and you increase the amenities and the consumption, you get a problem when you're in the middle of a desert.
And it's not just in the U.S., of course. Here from Lintao, China, just a couple of months ago, a city of 200,000 people began to run out of water. Here's a young woman talked to Marketplace about how it changed her daily life.
Right after Chinese New Year, water stopped coming out of the tap. Now we have to stand in line each morning with our buckets and wait for water to be delivered.
Las Vegas looking for answers. Zach in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Zach, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I've done a little studies about the innovations in water technology, and with being a water plant operator down here in Oklahoma City.
Oh, good.
I've seen this thing called, well, the technology is a water implosion, which basically it restructures the water molecules, and they've done some trials overseas. I want to say it was in France on just small agricultural setups, you know, like 8-inch distribution lines. And I do believe the numbers were something along the lines of, with using half the water, they made like a double crop output.
And what is the what was the benefit of restructuring the water molecules? Did you get to that, Zach?
It makes it more readily absorbable by basically anything.
Interesting.
Namely the plants that they used it, the crops that they used it on. And I do believe, I'm not sure that they've had any widespread distribution tests as far as big cities, but it could be a huge thing if it does pick up and kick off in some city.
So, or it sounds strong for agriculture in particular, hyper-absorbent or absorbable water. I mean, Nate, take us on a little tour of the far frontier. If you're positioning yourself as the water innovation hub, that sounds pretty out there. Restructuring the molecules of water. Where do you see innovation going? What direction, Nate? What's the frontier?
Well, from my standpoint, I think some of the biggest issues are for municipalities, where you have this demand to change some business models of how utilities operate and how they stay afloat in conditions where the water supply is going down. They have got to do more conservation, and where then you come up with demands for water recycling. You know, I think that Ted brought up earlier in the show how, you know, Las Vegas does indirect potable reuse, right, where we treat wastewater to a very high level before we put it back into the lake, and then we can take that water back out and send it into the city, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Frankly, it's very similar to what you guys have out east, except, you know, it's somebody else's wastewater they put in the river, and then Boston takes it back out right before it goes in the ocean, right?
Mm.
The difference here is that when the amount of water goes down, you have less new water coming in to dilute concentrations that could potentially build up.
Right.
We're not in the risk zone now, but we can see that coming. And so there's going to be a crux where we really have to get serious about how do we both conserve water, how do we maintain our quality, and how do we keep all of our infrastructure up to date, and what those big challenges are. And frankly, all of that comes down to optimizing how we use and manage our water so we are as efficient as possible.
Brian, why do you look at this? I mean, they're talking about a smart grid for water. We hear about that with power, but here now, smart grid with water. We talk about effluent supply modeling, what comes back out, how that looks, and all these different, you know, monitoring in real time all the pipes and how the water's moving and drones over the farms. But how do you see the limits of technology, Brian, when you look at demand for water globally coming at us?
Well, Tom, I often get asked by my friends and colleagues how I can get up every morning and remain optimistic about our potential. And my quick answer is always that, ironically, it's because we use water so poorly that we waste so much that there's huge potential for us to be able to get ourselves out of this bind in many places in the world. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. I think Nate and Ted both hit on this, that the most cost-effective measure or strategy for getting yourself out of a water shortage, out of a water scarcity situation, mm-hmm. is to invest in water conservation, improved efficiency. It's far cheaper to go after this problem in that manner rather than to invest on the infrastructure side of building the pipelines and the reservoirs and yep. And the other measures. So I think this is really, really important. And I do think that combined between the cities and the farms and doing that in collaboration, I am optimistic that we can find our way out of this.
Mike in Greenbush, Wisconsin. Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Two simple solutions: composting toilets and municipal-scale PB water pumping. The Grand Canyon has composting toilets, which use absolutely no water, and you're not taking fresh water, 1 to 3 gallons, to flush waste and make it into black water.
Yeah.
And the best use for solar PV, by far, is to do work, and that constitutes either pumping air or pumping water.
Wait a minute. What is solar PV? I couldn't follow you there. What is that? What?
Municipal-scale solar PV water pumping. A solar panel does the best thing at pumping water, and it's most efficient, it's most cost-effective. Anything with solar electricity that's not pumping water is wasting energy. So pump water with solar in and out of Lake Michigan, in and out of every community, and you're doing much more for the electric grid and also for efficiency, and that's where solar makes sense, and composting toilets as well.
Got them both. The composting toilets, get the water out of that. Brian, what about solar as the source, municipal scale, for pumping energy?
Well, I think it's a really important point, and it's important because so many of these technologies are very energy intensive. They use a lot of electricity, which makes them very expensive, whether we're talking about water recycling or desalination or just moving water across long distances. So much of the water problem is linked to the energy challenges.
Right.
And of course, we don't want to be investing in things that are going to cause much greater carbon emissions that are changing our climate. And so we need to find alternative sources of energy like solar and get it to scale. On these notes, the Saudi Arabians, who have built the most desalination plants mm-hmm. of any country in the world, they're now building the world's largest desalination facility. So there is a lot of potential here. And if we can find ways of generating more energy in safe, environmentally friendly ways, it can enable a lot of these technologies and resolve a lot of these water shortages that we're talking about.
Chris in Hartford, Connecticut, you're on with our panel.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is economic. Is it between climate change, which is becoming globally recognized,
yep.
and issues like Flint, which is, you know, there's so much contamination across the country and the world,
yep.
is this not just another byproduct of lack of political will to help the American people and the population of the world?
What do you mean, Chris? I mean, they're trying to dig in here and figure out new ways. You don't think it's going to be these new technologies will be equitably distributed?
No, I just think that I heard a gentleman say that it's more cost effective to find smaller ways to innovate as yep. opposed to rebuilding infrastructure and distributing water that way.
Yeah.
So you can create jobs by rebuilding the infrastructure while using the new technologies. If you didn't have so much political misuse.
Well, I think you said conservation is cheaper than rebuilding, but Nate, how about it? How you're in the thick of this. How big a portion of what we're up against do you think Las Vegas or anybody else can solve by innovation rather than good old-fashioned fundamental good pipes in the ground and, you know, and brimming sources of water?
Well, I think there's only so many water resources that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
And this conversation, you know, whenever it happens, not just here, right? It's people like to talk about the dwindling resources and how the resource availability is changing from climate change. And all of that is true, right? All of that
yep.
is and significant. But as Brian pointed out earlier, I mean, the amount of potential for making serious improvements in how we manage the infrastructure resources that we have now is really tremendous.
There's the bet that Las Vegas is making. Watch that dipstick in the aquifer meanwhile. Watch those rivers. Watch those reservoirs. In the end, you've got to have the water. But take your point, Nate. The way we use it, being smart about how we use it, a huge deal. We wish you luck at WaterStart. Executive Director Nate Allen in Vegas, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Ted Goldman, who's written it all up for Politico. You're terrific, Ted. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
And Brian Richter, Chief Scientist for the Global Water Program at the Nature Conservancy. Thank you for being with us today, Brian.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Listeners, don't get too thirsty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.